But the market gave you the signal weeks ago that something isn't right. Inflation shocks are actually rising at a faster rate than growth impulses. They're basically cannibalizing growth. It's really a stagflationary regime that's been coming to fruition under the surface here, and the market's telling you that.
Market Radar is a group of two macro experts that specialize in navigating markets with data-driven insights.
Regime-based strategies and systematic signals designed to cut through noise and improve decision-making for investors and traders.
So when the market loses trend, even if the regime is risk-on, you have to respect it. People are not going to expect those relief rallies to be material because they think that the entire cause of what's happening right now is just Iran-related. We might be at this Rubicon where that is actually not the case.
Hey, guys. I hope you've been enjoying the episodes I've been putting out as much as I do. For me, it's been a great journey with less noise, more signal, talking to all these experts all the time. With each and every episode, I feel like I have new points to ruminate on, things to ponder over. And yeah, I've just been learning so much. So if it's the same for you, I'd appreciate you subscribing to the show on YouTube, also commenting with the episodes when you have something to say, like it and share with your friends and families and colleagues. That would be much appreciated. And that way we could reach more people with this great content and grow together. So thanks a lot for doing this. Much appreciated. And yeah, let's go. Hey guys, welcome back to Less Noise, More Signal. Today, I'm honored to have Market Radar with me, which I thought is only one person, but then all of a sudden, two people are showing up on the screen, which is very nice. So it's great to have you guys here. But yeah, maybe you can introduce yourself on your own. I can just say Market Radar, it's an X account. It's a website that I've been following for quite some time now. For everything's market related. So yeah, it's great to have you guys on.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Yes. So maybe if you could quickly introduce yourselves, you know, like where you're coming from, what's your project and how have you found your way into macro and markets? That would be great.
Market Radar was initially formed on the premise of having an open style systematic model that we can share with the public. We spent a lot of time fine-tuning these models before even launching Market Radar, and afterwards, obviously continuing to improve our models and system. And we really take the approach that the macro space and the trading space is heavily crowded with a lot of noise, as your podcast says, less noise, more signal, right? So we're really focused on the signal. And what we really want to do is we want to isolate signal from noise and react more towards signal than to emotional drivers that you may see on the timeline or even feel if you're just watching the price action. And it's something that has allowed us over the last couple of years to really avoid a lot of bear markets. And it's something that I think will continue to allow us to basically navigate periods of extreme uncertainty and stress in the markets and come back and compound when things are a lot calmer or more clear.
Yeah. And to add to that, we use a regime-based model. We believe that the stock market and the bond market move mostly on growth and inflation expectations. Those are the main drivers. So the goal of our system that we've created is to measure growth and inflation expectations as accurately as possible. And based on those outputs, we decide where the best place is to allocate our money. That's basically the short explanation of what we do.
Yeah, that's interesting. I might want to get into this a little deeper if possible. But I mean, you guys said something about following the signal and kind of abstract from all the emotions and everything that's out there. I mean, it's probably easier said than done. Or I mean, how are you doing this? You know, is it that you're strictly following your system that you've built yourself? And then like, what are sort of the kind of components or what is your system built around? High level. So if you could fill us in, that would be great.
So I'm going to share my screen here. And this is our quant-based dashboard, which is available to members. And what this is essentially a summary of our signals on a refreshed on a daily basis. And the main core of our model is growth and inflation impulses, or our growth inflation impulses. And that's where the top line of the positioning is formed, right? Because without these regime outputs and growth and inflation inputs, you don't have a basis to start or manage a position from a top-down perspective. So if growth impulses are bullish and inflation impulses are also bullish, you end up in this inflation quadrant, and vice versa. If growth were to fall and inflation were to fall, you'd be in a deflation quadrant. And that's how this works. And typically, more times than not, the economy actually rotates in a semi-clockwise fashion, where you'll go from expansion to inflation, maybe back and forth, and then you'll go from inflation to stagflation. Less likely back and forth, but possible. And then stagflation to deflation, maybe back and forth, and then back up to expansion. Now, you typically won't be in inflation and go to deflation, or stagflation and go to expansion, vice versa. You don't really cross the axis like that. And I think that this is where at least having an understanding of where you are in the rotational part of the macro cycle gives you some sort of advantage. At least we believe, in our models seem to show, that being positioned for where you are within the cycle allows you to concentrate bets in certain areas and avoid bets or avoid risk in others, right? So for example, anything below the zero line here would imply that the growth index, anything below the x-axis would imply the growth index is bearish, right? And that would imply that overall you're in a risk-off regime. And in that situation, you don't even want to be looking, even if the market's bullish trend, we have a trend model as well, right? So like, even if we look at just NASDAQ, right now it's bearish trend, NASDAQ is broken trend. But even if NASDAQ was bullish trend and the regime model is telling you, you have to be careful, that is the starting point. So for you to get long risk assets, you first have to have a risk on regime. And right now, we're actually seeing something interesting happen in the markets where the regime model is risk on, but the markets are breaking down. And our basis for the reason why this is happening is actually that recent news around inflation fears and just inflation, positive inflation impulses, aka inflation shocks, are actually rising at a faster rate than growth impulses. So they're basically cannibalizing growth the growth impulses. And you're getting these early signals that we may be heading towards the lower right quadrant here, which would be a stagflationary regime.
Imagine lowering your tax bill while stacking Bitcoin. With Blockware, you can. Thanks to new tax guidelines, you can write off 100% of your mining hardware costs in a single year. Blockware's mining as a service takes care of everything, so you can start mining Bitcoin effortlessly. Visit mining.blockwaresolutions.com/LNMS and get $100 off for your first miner.
Yeah, exactly. I was just going to ask, because ever since the last couple of weeks, especially also because of the war, and we will probably get into this as well, but a lot of people have probably kind of turned bearish when it comes to equities and other risk assets, you know? And then from what I can see, because that would have been like my layman sort of question, you know, like, okay, the regime map is still kind of signaling risk on. How do you kind of reconcile the fact with the sort of sentiment that people currently have? I mean, you already explained, but maybe if you could, in terms of inflation, I have sort of the feeling, yeah, inflation, to some extent, it might be bullish, but then if inflation way gets out of hand, I mean, that can then also kind of be a kind of bearish outlook, right? Is there sort of a threshold there, or how do you look at this?
Yeah, so in an environment like this where inflation, the inflation index, or we'll call them impulses for simplicity here, if growth impulses and inflation impulses are both bullish, typically in a true inflationary risk-on regime, which is the top right quadrant, the growth index tends to lead the inflation index, meaning inflation impulses are not overpowering the growth impulses. And what ends up happening is in an environment where inflation impulses are strong enough where they start kind of weighing and bleeding into the growth impulses, you start moving down to what's the stagflationary regime. And that's where you get the kill off in growth. So your growth fades before inflation does. And then you're in this regime where there's these high perceptions of inflation, but low perceptions of growth. And that's where things that, like, for example, gold and industrial metals, they may continue to run where the market overall is getting hosed or getting hurt. And at some point, those negative growth impulses then over basically become a cannibalizer for the inflation impulses. So just as inflation killed growth, if growth falls enough, growth will kill inflation, and then you'll end up in this deflationary regime where both are going down together. So it's a symmetrical relationship where at first inflation destroys growth, and then when growth is down enough, growth will then come back and destroy inflation. And that's where I think we're stuck between right now, is the fact that growth impulses just aren't as strong as they should be given where inflation impulses are. And that's going to weigh, I think that's under the surface has been giving off some stagflationary vibes in the markets. And the reason why we have this double checking approach is exactly for what's going on right now. So we're not going to wait until the regime flips to take risk assets off the table, because as you can see at this particular time in this regime, the market broke bullish trend almost a month ago. So the market was front running this. And most of the time, the regime model does front run. So in this environment, because of the surge in inflation impulses, under the surface, they're eating away at growth. But on the surface, when you look at this, it looks like it's risk on. But it's really a stagflationary regime that's been coming to fruition under the surface here. And the market's telling you that. So when the market loses trend and we're along the market because it's a risk on regime, well, we have to cut our risk. So it's a multi-stage process, right? So if the regime model is risk on and the market is bullish trend, it's a long. But if the market loses trend, even if the regime is risk on, you have to respect that the conditions no longer align and everything's not aligned, and you have to de-risk accordingly. And that's where I think a lot of people get confused. They see something like this and they're like, oh, it's risk on, fade the market, buy the dip. Yeah, it could work. But like, you know, you're also in a position, like I just said, where sometimes the market does front run the regime model. And that's where in an environment like this, if you're buying this dip, and hypothetically, let's just say it keeps on dipping, in reality, the regime model is your backstop, right? And the regime model could take some time to catch up. And you don't have a stop loss at this point. Whereas the way we design our models is there's always some sort of stop loss to get you out of a trade if the conditions no longer align. And that's where I think you have to weigh both signals equally. And you can't just look at one side of the equation and say, oh, the NASDAQ's bullish trend, but the regime map is risk off. Ignore this or vice versa. They have to work in tandem. And that's where we found a lot of great results, is by allowing the double checking back and forth for verification.
Yeah, that's very well laid out. I mean, very clear cut. That makes a lot of sense to me. Maybe two follow-up questions in terms of the model. And I know I don't want you to give away your secret sauce in any way, but still kind of how do you kind of assess trend? You know, I assume it was the orange line. Is this okay, a simple moving average? Or yeah, and then also the inflation index. I mean, how are you kind of what are sort of the components going into this index? Yeah, if you could shed some light there, that would be cool.
Yeah, so we're not going to talk direct components, but what I will say is generally for both indexes, what we do is we look for broad-based measurements of implied pricing, and we map these out in the sense where we try and formulate a relative strength gauge for these impulses. Whereas if you were to say, look at the inflation index, it's really strong, it's in a bullish trend. Okay, what does this mean? Does this mean CPI is going to a certain number? No, that's not what this means. This is not a direct conversion of a headline CPI or a headline GDP print. This is not what this is. This is essentially measuring momentum under the surface, right? And to do that, we have to have a trend model. And fortunately for us, we have a trend model here that we use on equity prices. And what we do is it's modified slightly, but it's a similar concept where the trend model, what you're seeing here, this is not a simple moving average. This is more of a momentum-based average, right? Or momentum-based indicator. It's not really an average. And it gives you kind of the pivot point, or essentially the pivot point for trend direction, right? So if you go below this and momentum builds below this trend pivot, what's going to happen is you're going to go from bullish to neutral to bearish and vice versa. So for you to flip trend, if there's a really strong push above the moving average, right? Or that's what we want to call this, like for simplicity takes, then what ends up happening is you're going to get a
trend flip. And that trend flip is what's material for our models, because that's what sends us into these different segmented regimes, right? So if we are above this, and we call this line MoMA, like Market Radar. So I guess I'll just use that, because that's our nickname. That's what we call the DDAP trend level MoMA. And that's what this is in itself. So if we're above MoMA and we start ripping up, trend risk flips to going the other way and vice versa. And this isn't so much a directional bet that, you know, if the inflation index is up here, we're not betting that 5% CPI because of how strong it is going to happen. That's not where money's made in the markets. If anything, markets are by definition a trend mechanism, right? So you can't really participate in markets that do not trend and make money. It's one of these weird things where everyone likes to take a shot at momentum traders. But in reality, if you buy an asset that has no momentum, are you making any money? No. But inherently, everyone's a momentum trader, if you really think about it, right? If you're making money, you're along the things with momentum, you're inherently buying momentum. Now, some people quantify this differently as momentum names like MAG7, et cetera. But in reality, like, for example, right now, oil has momentum. If you're long oil, you're long momentum. You're just long momentum in the oil sector, right? Or energy. You're long momentum in the energy sector. So in an environment where you can gauge where momentum is shifting along the inflation and growth impulses, you inherently can catch earlier shifts that bleed into the markets, where the markets may be in an inflation regime and momentum has not built for stagflation, or you're in deflation and the momentum has not yet built for a recovery back to the risk on expansionary regime. And by being able to read momentum early on, you get into a position where you can essentially front run long, prolonged bull markets and bear markets. And that's exactly what we try to do here at Market Radar, is really isolate those momentum pivot points, get in and just ride the trend. You know, if growth impulses are bullish, inflation impulses are bullish, and the NASDAQ is bullish trend and we're long risk assets, and someone comes out and starts saying, oh, you know, there's a debt maturity wall coming, you know, for tech companies and AI companies, and our models are all bullish, we're not going to give a crap about what anyone is saying, because at the end of the day, momentum is like a flywheel, right? So if the flywheel is really spinning, you need something to make it start spinning the other way. And those are shocks that typically no one can see coming. And those are shocks that start forming slowly. You can think about it like this, right? Right now, everyone's talking about private credit. Right now, everyone's talking about Iran. Right now, everyone's talking about anything you could possibly imagine. But the market gave you the signal weeks ago that something's wrong, right? Before we got down to 566 on the QQQ, the market gave you the signal that something isn't right.
I mean, actually, like, the market gave us a signal like back in October, just for context as well. Like, we went into stagflation back in October, and the market really hasn't gone any higher since then.
Right. There was a small risk on pivot in here, but that was quickly invalidated by the neutral trend. And long story short, like, what's going on in the markets, it's not, from a normal perspective, if you're just opening your Twitter feed or your X feed and you're just scrolling every day, this is a shock in some weird way. Like, you're seeing like, oh, Iran, like, this is all just happening at once. This is all Iran related because that's what's on the timeline. But the market has not been able to make a high for months. I mean, if you look at NVIDIA, right? NVIDIA looks like this. It has not broken above the base it's made since August. So there are things that are going on here that right now we will still see how they develop. They may turn out to be nothing, but I personally think, look, the market broke trend. You have companies like NVIDIA and bearish trend, and they haven't gone anywhere since August, which means it's not even related to Iran. Like, it's not like NVIDIA was in a vertical line and then Iran happens and it collapses. There's things that are developing under the surface here that I think people want to give too much credit to towards Iran. And that, I think, is going to be a problem, because what that's going to do is, if I'm right on this aspect, which this is more of a discretionary note, any relief rally that's instigated by Iran peace talks, well, people are not going to expect those relief rallies to be faded. They're going to expect those relief rallies to be material, because they think that the entire cause of what's happening right now is just Iran related. So you remove the Iran risk, we're at all-time highs. And I have a feeling that we might be at this Rubicon where that is actually not the case.
Hey guys, I'm thrilled to share my new book, The Bitcoin Enlightenment, co-authored with Mexican billionaire Ricardo Salinas. Make sure you grab your copy now and learn about how one of the richest people in all of Latin America thinks about Bitcoin. You'll find the link in the show notes.
That's a very great point to point out. I mean, in the end, people are looking for these narratives to kind of make sense of it all. But yeah, you're right. I mean, ever since October, I mean, I'm, as I said in the beginning offline, you know, I'm pretty much looking at Bitcoin as well. I guess you guys are too. And
yep.
And that one also gave us a signal way back in October that things are kind of out of whack, you know, and that a lot of people back then were kind of saying, well, yeah, Bitcoin is just behaving weirdly, but in some sense, it kind of really front ran all of it, which was coming. And then again, yeah, the Iran and the private credit and everything, all these narratives are just sort of things to make sense of what's happening after the fact, after fact. That's at least
that's exactly how it feels. Yeah. Yeah. And what you, and a good example here is what ended up happening was this liquidation candle. I'm sure you're very familiar with this whole, like, yeah, this cascade here in October. Our models were pretty much selling out on the bounce here because this coincided with a regime shift at the time. And even though we got back into a risk on regime, somewhere around here, Bitcoin being bearish trend is, again, back to that double check verification. Just because Bitcoin is, just because the models are risk on, even if Bitcoin's bearish, we don't just buy Bitcoin. There needs to be a confirmation signal that the risk regime is aligning with the trend. If that doesn't work, then there's no trade. And what this essentially has allowed us to do is sidestep all this Bitcoin noise. So we've been out of Bitcoin since about 116,000, 117,000, and we're just sitting here waiting. And realistically, what we want to see is we want to see the regime stay in a risk-on environment, which it is right now. But like as we were saying earlier, it seems to be slowly shifting. And Bitcoin go bullish trend, which means it's got a clear with momentum above 84,000 at this point, where it is right now. And that's not looking good. It's not looking like that's going to happen right now. It just doesn't look good. And people will say like, oh, you can buy here DCA. And you know, now you're talking two different investors, right? When we buy Bitcoin, we chase it with 2x leverage. So we leverage up, but when you have a trend in your favor with the regime, the leverage makes sense because I'm not carrying that 2x leverage on a 70% drawdown, right? So yeah. I can isolate those holding periods, but that also means if I can isolate those holding periods, why am I going to dumpster dive right here at 66,000 when there is no reason to buy? Could it go to, like, could Bitcoin go to 59,000, 56,000, 57,000? Yeah, the short of it here is asinine as well. Like, you're shorting a late stage bear market. That's also ridiculous. But you're at this point where people like to say, you ever go on the timeline, the market's down. It's like, oh no, it's the market's down too much for me to sell, but not enough for me to buy. Yeah. that's where we are with Bitcoin right now.
Yeah. And like the reason we have this check and balance, like with both the technical side of it with DDAP and then our system as well, is because you can have a risk on regime that is good for some risk assets, but it's not enough for other risk assets. Like, for example, Bitcoin is as far as you can get on the risk curve. I mean, outside of altcoins and other things like that. But Bitcoin is one of the riskiest assets you can get. And so you can have a risk on regime and there's ample liquidity in the market. Equities are going up, but Bitcoin still can't because there's just not enough risk appetite. It's a risk on regime, but it's not strong enough to put risk out this far out onto the risk curve. And so that's why it's really important to have the DDAP trend as well as a second check.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Yeah, and you're definitely right. I mean, just maybe because people love stories and narratives, as we said. I mean, we were seeing DDAP, the model. It's been quite clear, you know, back in November, like late October, it kind of shifted. But why do you think has it shifted? Like, what are the underlying drivers? Was it just the market kind of looking for a reason to go down, and then because it has already extended and it was sort of overextended, or like what could it be under the hood that is kind of driving this, you know? Because I feel like as we established, Iran as well as like maybe private credit, these can kind of late now in this cycle, so to say. So anything else that comes to mind if we want to speculate here?
Yeah, so I think the biggest issue with these narratives is the idea that they're idiosyncratic, right? So like there's no relation to narratives don't relate to each other. And what I mean to expand on that by is saying this liquidation that happened here on 10/10, right? This massive liquidation. You kind of have seen this actually happen with oil lately. If you look on you just see these oil wicks that are essentially destroying market structure. And this is headline manipulation for a reason. But what goes on is when you destroy market structure like this, automatically you shake up sentiment. Sentiment is like you get people that, number one, have to reduce size because there's too much uncertainty. And that alone can start the spinning of a flywheel, right? So think of the flywheel like it spins to the right or it spins to the left. It doesn't just sit still. Like either markets are rising or they're falling, right? And the right is rising, left is falling, right? Going backwards. So once this 10/10 liquidation hit, I think the market structure was fractured, however it may be. And then you also had this entire dynamic that we've been talking about with trade uncertainty at the time. This all started with China, uncertainty around growth, uncertainty around a lot of things happened around this period. And as Bitcoin failed to bounce and recover, essentially what happened was the flywheel started to slowly start spinning the other way. Lost trend, that flywheel starts accelerating. And this is all in juncture with the NASDAQ actually not like going anywhere. Like the NASDAQ barely broke out, faded. It's gone nowhere. So remember what Artie just said, Bitcoin is a representation of the thing furthest out in the risk curve because it has no cash flows. It's not physical, it's all digital, right? So it's really something way all the way out on the right of the curve. So if risk assets are not moving higher and they're struggling for whatever reasons under the surface, maybe growth, tariff-related, growth-related, political instability related, nobody wants US assets, whatever that may be, and that is a flywheel that feeds onto other markets as well. All in all, you have the situation where flywheel starts spinning the other way, and then a couple of more nukes happen and the flywheel really starts accelerating. And now Bitcoin is in its own bear market. It's just like it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. And this continues and this goes. And funny enough, like this happens all while the markets aren't unable to break new highs. So it's not like Bitcoin is falling 50% and the NASDAQ is, up 45, 50%. It's not what's going on. This is just a release valve where if you think about this liquidity conditions, I mean, we track this on our website. We take a look here. Liquidity conditions, they were negative in November. They tried to go positive in December and they completely have been pancaked ever since. Like they've been absolutely pancaked. So another way one could simplify this is if you look at volatility, right? You look at VIX, you look at where it is. VIX is at 29, almost 30 today as we're recording this. This by no means is an investable environment that's favorable for risk assets. It's just, it's not, because every day the market can be up or down 1%, 1.5% easily in this environment, right? And do you really want to chase the thing furthest out on the risk curve in this environment? Probably not. And this is where it comes back to that flywheel we were talking about spinning, because VIX has not been able to really hold below 20 for months now, essentially. Over a month. We've been above 20 for a month. And we have not been a below 15 for all the way back, going back to pretty much January. We peaked below the beginning of the year and it's been up and to the right. And this is something that's not favorable for risk assets. And respectfully, Bitcoin is the riskiest of them all. So how could you expect Bitcoin to remotely trade well if the overall environment is just not favorable?
No, it's so great what you're telling me here, because also obviously it's all in retrospect, but it kind of validates also the theory that I had, because I had some other people on the show way back in summer, like early summer, and then in July. And one of the people that I had on the show, he actually told me that, and I was looking at this myself when you look on chain, that the real top for Bitcoin was in July. That was like not the price top, yeah, but when you were looking, yeah, at like what kind of inflows you had on on-chain basis and stuff. And then only it went sideways. It had this last push up in October, but it was already showing you, okay, this is not right. And then the trend broke down. And if we go back to QQQ, I think you had the same thing a little later, but then it was the same in October. That was probably the real top in that sense. And then it all just kind of consolidated and started to roll over. And so in that sense, it makes a ton of sense to me that Bitcoin being the most risky asset, as apart from alts, as you said,
is really the one going first and the others are kind of following. So it is all after the fact, but it really adds up in my mind. Yeah.
Yeah. And we haven't even talked about the IGV crush. I mean, that was a thing, right? Like yeah. this broke in November, and IGV structurally is completely different than QQQ. If you like, I'm a firm believer that QQQ will hit all time highs without IGV. Because I do think that there's a discount mechanism in here that has to play a role through artificial intelligence and software, right? The sector is absolutely destroyed. But if you were to do a quick comparison, like long QQQ and short IGV, this has been something that's been working for many months now, and really bottomed out in 2019. Like IGV stopped outperforming tech in like 2020. And so this is not like a new phenomenon, but it's definitely accelerated significantly in the last 6 to 8 months. And this is where I think like, okay, there'll be some dead weight in this basket, because this basket is not an index in the sense where like in the NASDAQ, you have a variety of companies. This is isolated to a subsector it's isolated to a subsector in the index, right? So that's, you're betting on this subsector outperforming the rest of the market. And it's hard to say that that will actually, that'll actually be a thing coming forward. Whereas I feel like a lot of people are looking for a bull market and this a complete recovery here, where this actually is in tune with Bitcoin, right? Because a lot of people were overlaying Bitcoin on this chart too, saying that the decline in tech. I mean, we can actually do that right here. So let's take a look.
I think there is like a bit of a relationship there with like, even if you pull up like Nvidia, like that kind of peaked back in like June, July as well, hasn't really gone anywhere since. And I think that just kind of tells us that the momentum of the whole AI wave and the expectation of massive growth, massive liquidity, like that's what Bitcoin needs to succeed and significantly outperform. That's what was being priced in back then. But then as July, August, September rolled around, that all these other AI names, you can see they just kind of started topping, as if the market's starting to price in, okay, maybe this massive AI growth is starting to get overextended. And I think that's also just another factor that played into Bitcoin topping as well back then.
Yeah, and I would actually make the public bet that Bitcoin recovers well before IGV does. So a lot of people are looking at this correlation saying, okay, like, you know, if you're buying Bitcoin here, you're buying IGV. And I do not think that's the same. I don't think that correlation holds up over time. I think that if you're looking at this from a risk perspective, IGV has a lot of a lot more risk that Bitcoin doesn't have to carry. Bitcoin's a plain vanilla out on the curve risk asset. It's aggressive. It makes sense. There's logic there, right? And like, if you look at the IGV sector, there's companies in there like Salesforce, which I don't think are going out of business, but they are going to be weighed down by, there's going to be some premium that's taken off their earnings or future earnings because of artificial intelligence.
Yeah, that's a very good point to point out as well. Because, I mean, obviously, colleagues of mine, they're looking at IGV and they're like, okay, no, valuations have come down and that's why they might be favorable. And yeah, you want to kind of for a quick jump and then and flip that. But you're definitely right. I feel like the headwinds are way too strong in terms of AI. And I think a lot of people are still underestimating what's to come here. And that's why, yeah, they have to be completely distinguished and separated out. So it's definitely something interesting to look at. In terms of Bitcoin, I mean, one question that I would have is interest rates. You know, how much do they feed into your entire model? I mean, a lot of people are looking to interest rates and also the nominal and real interest rate in terms of like, okay, real interest rates are pushed down. That's why liquidity could kind of improve and that would be bullish Bitcoin. Are you looking at this at all, or is it really just inflation and growth regime model that you have?
I think the most important, so I want to touch on a couple of things that you said there. One being interest rates and then how they flow through the model. So I think the most important thing about interest rates that a lot of people overlook, the macro aware know this already though, is that it doesn't really matter where the Fed is right now. It's irrelevant. It matters where the curve is pointing towards in the next 6 to 12 months, right? So in sense, the market, right, and the economy are reacting off of where interest rates are going to go. Like, think about it like this. Mortgage rates don't really care about where the Fed is today, right? If you get a mortgage rate, you're trading the curve. You're wherever the curve is, that's where you're placed at, right? So how rates flow through the economy is very anchored to where the Fed's forward policy or forward guidance is sitting at the moment. And I think that if you look at it from an economic perspective, you don't necessarily need to gauge where rates are today. You just have to have an understanding of where the market is implying rates are going to go. And that alone can positively or negatively affect growth and inflation impulses under the surface. So you don't necessarily need to measure where the market's going to go in terms of growth, interest rates, because in theory, the market's already priced this in. It's a discount mechanism. So it's actively absorbing that change real time. Like for example, the odds of let's just say the forward curve falls and all of a sudden they expect 7 rate cuts, 8 rate cuts, right? Over the next 2 years. If the market is 100% aware of this, if you think that the market's like, oh, it's delayed, it doesn't realize the cuts are coming. Like, this is not how this works. Trillions of dollars flow through these markets every day. There are desks way more advanced than us that are literally linked to arbitrage scenarios and dislocation within markets on perceived pricing. So if you think like the market's going to all of a sudden, you know, one day wake up and say, you know what, the Fed's pricing eight rate cuts, we should probably start ripping. Like, that's not how this works, unfortunately. It would be too easy if it was.
And I mean, there's this one theory floating around out there, especially now, you know, with Trump being in office. I mean, be curious what you think on this, because like a lot of people are like, okay, I guess they're coming around to the fact that markets are dictating where interest rates are going. That's, I think, what you're saying as well. It's really the markets are leading the curve here. But then, I mean, a lot of people are saying, well, because Trump really wants to lower these interest rates, you know, they could be politically manipulated down. Are you buying any of this, or how do you think about this? Like who's sort of driving, you know, who's in the driving seat here? Yeah.
So I think a good point to volley off of what you just said was, number one, do you believe, or does one believe, that the market is essentially a derivative of the economy, right? So do you believe that the market is the economy? Yes or no, right? And this is a question everyone has to ask themselves, because some people will say the stock market is not the economy. The stock market is not the economy. This is something. But let's think about this in a simplistic view. If on a base case, we'll use ES, for example, S&P. If S&P is at 7,000, okay? And then S&P or ES goes to 5,000, right? Do you think that has a negative economic impact? Yes or no? And I'd argue that, of course, people are going to less likely to spend. Their morale around investments are lower, right? Because like, if you think about this on a really, really broad base, startups, they need to raise capital. They need financing. And if the market is 30, 40, 50, 40% off of its highs or 30% off of its highs, well, the ability for them to access capital is going to be tighter. People are less willing to take risk. And this all is a shock towards future growth, right? That's why the market in a way is a representation of the economy, always has been, always will be. And it's just a representation of sentiment, of risk taking, right? If the market is ripping 20% a year, year over year, and there's real growth there, people are very, very likely to write checks, to make investments, to innovate in new spaces. A good example of this is, if the market were to fall 40% from here and all the AI names were to fall 40%, do you think that would stunt the evolution of artificial intelligence? I think it would. I think it would be a major roadblock that we'd have to overcome if AI is going to continue, because the ability for these companies to borrow on the arm is going to go down if the entire market smoked, right? And then you can look at it as a follow-through effect. The market goes down 40%. All these AI companies that are building these data centers, which have been a core driver of growth the last year and a half, right? A lot of growth has been stemming from data center construction, build out, blue collar work, all these things. If they start pulling back there, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy where now you actually have another material hit to growth going forward, and it just feeds into itself. So the market can dictate sentiment, which at the end of the day, anyone writing a check to do any investment, to fund any deal, to do anything, is going to be influenced by where the market is. And I think that's what people mistake, like, oh, you know, the markets are down, but the economy's really, really strong. Yeah, the economy looks strong today, but if the market falls 30%, I don't see how GDP stays at, you know, 2-3, like, just it won't. It won't. There will be negative consequences.
Yeah, I mean, in the end, it's sort of this thinking also that a lot of people were now saying, okay, you know, with this oil shock, the whole war that we're seeing, you know, this is super inflationary, you know, and it probably kind of will be in the beginning. And then sure. Only later on, you know, if you look out 2, 3, 4 months, I guess this is also where higher oil prices will then kind of have these disinflationary forces because like, yeah, people are spending less because prices have probably gone up, and that's why it then feeds through into some disinflationary forces. So looking out 3 to 4 to 5 months, how are you now thinking about the market going forward? And maybe also on that note, I mean, you know, Trump, he's famous for these tacos, you know, but I feel like the more tacos he's been serving, the less people are sort of buying these tacos, you know, because, and that's also what the market has been showing us as of late, you know, I think the last sort of rally was retraced quite quickly. And so, there's not a lot of cards he still seems to be having in his hand. And again, it's probably, he can't kind of force or kind of try to lean against the market if the market is going one way, you know, but well, yeah, curious to know how you look at all of what's coming.
Our belief on the tacos are quite simple, actually. Trump is notorious for his negotiations and deals, right? But the way he operates is quite interesting because all of his deals up until his entire second term have been around a position of independent strength. And you can think about this like this, right? If the rest of the world needs to dump their inventory in the United States, meaning like if America were to cut off of it, off all of its imports, the rest of the world would have a supply glut and they'd experience, they would have excessive production. They can't unload anywhere else, and they would in turn be negatively affected economically, maybe even a recession. So the rest of the world needs to dump their goods in America, understandably, right? China, one of them. Now, when you operate from and you negotiate from this leverage standpoint, you're really negotiating with yourself and the fact you can make a deal and you can walk it back because you have full head-to-tail control of the situation, right? You can allow or disallow someone to trade with you. You can, and this is where the Supreme Court came in and with their injunction and slowed this and pretty much stopped all this. But Trump had full operational control of the whole negotiation, where he basically could start and stop a negotiation without having the approval from or the consent from the other party, because the other party would need U.S. trade regardless, right? And the only country that was really, really hostile was China. Because they were going to play a tariff war, and eventually that still flowed through. Like the Chinese goods are still flowing through America. So this is where this all plays out, where Trump has the operational leverage just because he's operating from the United States' trade perspective. But if you take this to a confrontational standpoint with Iran, Trump doesn't have the same operational leverage in the sense that he can't negotiate the strait because he doesn't control the strait. Iran is in the situation that Trump was in with all these trade deals. Iran can say whatever they want, and unless their control of the straits removed, they have the negotiating leverage here. And this is the situation where I think the markets are trying to look for a Trump taco, but he can't taco on the situation because he doesn't have full control of it. And this is where I think why you're seeing these headlines about boots on the ground. You're seeing these confrontational headlines on how Trump's trying to become very aggressive with Iran, because he understands that he has no control over the outcome unless he gets negotiating leverage. And the only way to do that is to take the choke point that Iran has in all of this off the table. If Iran never had the strait to begin with, oil prices would have never done what they did, right? So he's pretty much
forced to escalate at this point.
Yeah.
He needs to end it because he can't just end it himself. He can't just pull out like he did with the tariffs. Like, okay, I'm going to lower the tariffs now. Like he can't just pull out anymore. And now
because he doesn't have the leverage.
Yeah. And he's also just kind of stuck now. Like Iran's bombing all the neighboring countries, American allies. He can't just leave now and risk the allies.
I mean, that's where he kind of backed himself into a corner, you know, like because that was to me just abstracting from everything very clear from the get-go, because I also feel like you have Israel on the side, you have Iran. If you just look at these two players there, you know, it's sort of ideologically driven what's going on here as well. And it's not maybe like Trump with this grand scheme of thing idea that he has. And so already there, you kind of knew, okay, if he starts something like this with Iran, Iran won't just go one day, okay, we'll call it the quits. It's all good, you know. No, they want to have this asymmetric warfare strategy, and they pull it off. But I mean, as you said, we also hear about peace talks, you know, that supposedly are going on, but then Iran is also kind of denying these. And so from what I'm hearing, what you're telling me is like Trump needs to get control over this strait, you know, and that's why I feel like boots on the ground, this is going to happen. I mean, we will need to go there. And he already signaled that he will be going there.
Well, think about it like this. And this is, again, this is more discretionary off-topping towards the models. But
yeah.
If Iran were to, let's just say, if 6 months ago, Iran were to come to the table and were to say, you know what, we're going to start charging a toll to cross the strait, $2 million a ship. They would have never had the audacity back then to do this, because they would start a conflict which they would not perceive as being able to win, right? At that point, maybe they didn't have the confidence of actually winning this. Well, now they're in a position where they are able to pull this off because the conflict started. They say, okay, we're going to toll the ships and we're going to have them run through a choke point. Anyone that's paying a toll that's not it's an ally, we'll let them through. But anyone that's not an ally, we control the strait. Now, in reality, 6 months ago, they wouldn't have been able to get this far under the assumption that they would then be in a conflict and they may not know if they'll win the conflict. But at this point, they're further enough along in the conflict where they can pull this off, and they currently are. So if Trump were to taco completely on the situation, he's essentially going to leave Iran in a more advantageous position than they were before this all began. Even if he says he killed Khamenei, even if he says the regime has changed, in reality, they now control something that is vital for global oil supply that they did not or weren't perceived as being able to control 6 months ago. So I think that this is the problem, where Trump can't just walk away from the strait, because if he does, what's going to happen is Iran's going to start getting cute with it and say, okay, well, if we could charge tolls, we can maybe do more things. Like, well, who's going to stop us now? And this is where I think it's a compounding problem that the world needs to solve diplomatically, but unfortunately, it doesn't seem like there's really a diplomatic solution at this point without boots on the ground.
Yeah. And like that, what we've been saying this whole time, like there's just so much propaganda. You don't know who to believe. There's news coming out of Iran. There's news coming out of Trump. And the bottom line is all of that is just noise. Really what matters is the strait open. That's all that matters. Until that happens, it's just a mess. Everything's a mess.
Yeah, that's good to boil it down to that point. I mean, that's definitely it. I mean, if it's closed, yeah, nothing is going through, or only the ones belong to the allies. And then, yeah, we know what will follow from this. But I mean, maybe one more point on this sort of discretionary talk before I want to maybe quickly go back to the module. But like, how do you think will this be solved? Or like, how will it kind of change to the better again, you know? Because currently, from what I can tell, it's not looking that well, but will it just fizzle out at some point? Or like, how do you think about this? I mean, we can only speculate, but I guess that's what people also like to hear, you know, perspectives from people on how this could solve.
So these viewpoints don't necessarily feed into our position, right? Like, we have some biased views on the Iranian situation, but those are basically a mere summary of our understanding of global macro and our perception of the timeline in its current state. So what you're saying is, could this fizzle out? Like, could there be a deal that happens in a month from now for whatever reason? Yeah, it's possible. Like, that's the thing about this. There's a possible scenario. You can't sit here and say it's a zero probability that there is a deal that happens, right? This is this is the global economy, multiple different parties, anything is possible, right? So I think you have to look at it from a sense and say this: as long as the strait is closed, regardless of the outcome, for example, if Trump were somehow to gain control if NATO were somehow to gain control of the strait, the conflict could still go on in Iran. You could still be attacking Iran, but if you have control of the strait, the oil will drop significantly, right? And the impacts of this conflict will be greatly different in markets, because now oil is not the direct driver anymore. And that's where I think, like, you know, you can have a fragment of outcomes here where NATO controls the strait, or NATO is able to clear the strait. Maybe NATO can escort the ships through the strait. Maybe Iran still controls the strait, but NATO is escorting ships. There's so many different things that could happen. If flow starts moving across the strait, whichever way possible, it's going to be very positive. And now, the counter argument to this is all Iran has to do is get Hezbollah to shoot some missiles in the other strait, the Bab el-Mandeb, I can't even say it, whatever strait that goes up to the Suez Canal, right?
If they start shooting missiles over there, the insurance companies are going to stop flow on that side, and you're going to have an even worse problem on your hands. So there's so many ways this can open up and compound. And that's the market. What the market's telling you is it's just you're in such a trench of uncertainty right now. And arguably, 5-10 years from now, will the S&P be higher? Will the NASDAQ be higher? Arguably, yes. But when we're trading with leverage the way that we are, we have to acknowledge that in periods of uncertainty, trading with leverage in this environment, when VIX is at 30, and they're talking about nuclear weapons on the timeline, there's something is not right. The market's been telling us that. And it's better to wait for resolution to size up leverage and really focus than sit here and pray to God boots don't touch the ground in Iran.
Turning back to the module, what would you be looking at, you know, for kind of like turning points to flash, you know, and to kind of see early signs of, okay, you know, like really not looking at the narratives and what's going on with macro, but just like the model, okay, this is kind of signaling that things are turning for the better, or yeah, what would you be looking for?
So the key here is going to be the model staying in risk on. That would be the first thing. Being that we're fading right now and we take a look at the weekly, and we go back 3 months. Let's take a look here. Let this load. So we were way up here and we've been fading. And if this goes below zero, it's problematic, right? That'll be in itself. But if we hold, okay, that's a positive sign. The next thing is going to be the markets recovering. The markets need to recover. The markets need to bottom out. This looks like we're taking out every range low and just cascading at this point. This is a complete crush. I mean, I'm sure as we bring recording this, VIX is even higher. Yeah, VIX is
now. To me, this feels like we're not even in capitulation yet. This feels like we're actually going to go quite a bit lower if this continues.
Yeah, I mean,
VIX is not even blowing out. You'd expect to see a VIX blowout before we even bottom.
Yeah, you basically have mags, right? Down, everything is down. It's not just oil, right? It's not just oil oil related. Like this is becoming a wider spread sell-off in the markets. I mean, Bitcoin's almost going to be, if this keeps up, Bitcoin will be at 65,000 before the afternoon. You know, like it's just a widespread systematic sell-off that continues to compound. And it's okay. Like this is, like if you're a long-term buyer, like this, you shouldn't be looking at this in here and saying, oh my God, the world's over. Like that's nonsense. We'll get through this. The markets will recover. But if you're trying to trade somewhat tactically, the sell signals passed us weeks ago. We're in this point now where it's all about letting the noise, basically the ball was dropped and now let the ball fall and peter out and stop rolling and start rolling and come to a stop. And then you can pick it up and you can go. But right now it doesn't make sense. There's just too much uncertainty to put any material trade on.
Bringing it back to the model, like if we were to go to stagflation, what we'd be looking for, stagflation is, as you said there, like that's the ball petering out. We're waiting for that ball to stop rolling and start kind of getting a base again. That's kind of when you start going into that deflation territory. So you have these inflationary pressures starting to die down, get into deflation. That's where you would start seeing bonds outperforming. You'd start seeing rate cuts coming on the table, kind of recessionary vibes type thing. Like that would start in stagflation and continue over into deflation. And then deflation, as you get out of there, that's really when you want to start pushing the fold into risk assets, is on that recovery out of the deflation. That's kind of the cycle that it's going to follow. If we dip into stagflation here, that's the likely cycle.
Yeah, very interesting. Very impressive, guys, what you've built here and very amazing insights that you're giving us here. I mean, I don't know if you have anything to add. I mean, if not, I would just ask you, like, where could they follow you? And if they want to gain access to these models, how can they do so?
Yeah, best place to follow us is on X at the Market Radar. That's where we post there every day. We post our thoughts every day. And then we got a website, market-radar.com. We have a free dashboard, so anyone can sign up, look at it. We've got tons of great macro insights, just charts that you can't really access elsewhere, like inflation swaps and things like that. Like, we've got some really valuable things here for free, all for free. And if if anyone wants access to our growth and inflation model and our portfolio allocations, then you can just also sign up on the website there. And we also have our own podcast every Thursdays.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely encourage people to check this out. I'll put everything in the show notes that is of relevance. So yeah, thanks guys a lot for taking the time. We're coming up on the hour here, so I want to leave it at that. Maybe we'll do something in the future again. If things are turning more bright again, we'll see. But thanks for taking the time and enjoy.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.